Okay, we'll make a start. The series of lectures that are going to be sort of happening in the next week or 10 days really stem from these initial two lectures that we're going to talk about Judaism and Christianity. Why I talk about this is really for a very basic reason. And the reason is the following, and this is a clip from a paper that somebody gave me from last year's New York Post, July 7, 2006. And what it was a advertising campaign on one of the corridors of the Grand Central Station, which was yesterday in the news. There was a massive explosion there. Most unbelievable sight of the road in the middle of New York, completely cars sunk into the road. Last year there was an advertising campaign from an organization known as Jews for Jesus, Jews for J. And what they did was they took over a whole corridor of adverts, which is a lot of advertising, you know, like one of these from the A train to the C train, or one of those sort of areas over there. And on each advert there was the sign Jesus for Jews, Jews for Jesus, with a web page, you know, how to get hold of them, etc., etc. And the amount of money that was used in this advertising campaign was running in the region of $1.4 million.
And who paid for it?
And they had the money. They've got enormous resources. Enormous.
Well, who supports that?
Now, we'll talk about that in a second. Whether this advertising campaign was successful or not, I don't really know. I sincerely hope it wasn't. Okay, sincerely. But at the same time, there are a lot of people out there who taken in by this sort of thing. And it's a very worrying development. About 30 years ago, now it's 35 years ago, there's a gentleman called Howard Rosen. He called himself Moshe Rosen. Okay, he made himself Jewish. And what happened was he started this organization, and it was a big change in the approach essentially to what is known as evangelical behavior, or evangelicism, whatever the word is. The tradition used to be, go back 1,000 years to the Crusades, and you'll read about it, that what they did was, whenever they came across Jewish community, particularly the Crusaders, who are the biggest bunch of cutthroats probably in the history of the world, apart from probably what we saw in the last 50, 60 years, and what they did was that they went to a Jewish community and they would say, either you embrace the cross or we kill you. Didn't give you much choice. In the 20th century, the whole derech, if you want to call it that, the whole way of doing this became much more subtle. Okay, don't embrace any crosses, you're not going to get killed, but what we are going to try and do is to get you to accept Judaism and Christianity at the same time. It was a new patent, it was a new invention. And what has happened in the last 30 years is quite frightening, because these organizations are really very successful. If you're talking in numbers, I don't know what the numbers are, but I do believe that the numbers are quite staggering. My own experience, my first trip to America, approximately 20-something years ago, and I was staying in Flatbush, and two things about Flatbush really surprised me, apart from everything else that goes on in Brooklyn, which I don't even want to discuss, but the one thing was walking along Coney Island Avenue and seeing in the middle of wherever, you know, sort of all the various Jewish institutions you got over there, there is a Messianic congregation. I believe it's still there. And this Messianic congregation, sorry, it closed. All right, well, presumably they'll open up somewhere else. It's like in Golders Green. They had the same thing. They had it for a number of years where I come from in London. And it was functioning. Okay, at that time it was functioning and people were coming in and people were being... who knows what sort of influences were going on there. It was really quite scary. The other thing which is really quite frightening is that the activities of groups like this are very much, how should I say, a blind eye is turned towards them, particularly in Israel. In Israel, more than anywhere else, the government seems to have gives them a blank check almost, just to get on with doing what they're doing. Over the years, they've built various centers. When I was living in Israel in the 80s, there was Beit Shalom in Gilo, which was a very big missionary place, and again, it's very scary that the how should we say, the allowance for this activity to go on is really very frightening. In back to Flatbush, what I did see at the time, I went into one of the bookstores, I think it was Hecht, I'm pretty sure Hecht bookstore, about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and in the back of the store there was a young man who was putting on tefillin, and I thought, all right, I don't know, this is Brooklyn, yeah, anything can go in. So I said, out of interest, you know, what's going on? Are you having a million pashakras at the back at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? So the guy said, no. He said, you should know that that young man is a very special young man. So I said, what's this, you know, you can't keep me hanging. What happened? So he said to me, he said that this young man has just managed to pull himself away from a missionary group, from a group of Jews for Jay. So I said, what do you mean? So he said, there is a group in Brooklyn, presumably that messianic place. And once they got hold of somebody, they wouldn't let you go. In other words, they would not in any way allow you to function outside their particular control. And this young man was trying to get back into the Jewish community, and he made an arrangement with the bookseller that he would come in to do tefillin in the afternoon, because they wouldn't expect you to do tefillin in the afternoon, do tefillin in the morning. So this young boy comes into the store apparently every single day at that time, was coming in order to put on tefillin. And again, I found that very shocking, that in the middle of what is essentially one of the strongest Jewish communities in the world, you've got this activity going on. It's nothing new. It happened on the Lower East Side. You had missionaries functioning right through the early period when Jewish immigration. You had in London. You had it all over the place. And the two groups that they really focus in on are the... they used to focus in on the elderly. People who were coming who had no financial support, or very little financial support, and they would offer money in order for you to join their particular congregations and whatever. This was an old story. But what they've done today is they've focused a lot more on the youth. And I talk about this because many of you will have children, grandchildren, certainly in college, and they should be made aware of this if they're not already aware of it. Many kids are aware of it, and there are many people in the field who are talking about it. Somebody called, what's his name? There's a rabbi from Monsey, Tuvia Singer. Rabbi Singer is a wonderful, wonderful guy who is trying to increase the awareness of all these problems. He does presentations on missionary activity, and he's fabulous. And if you can ever hear him, he's actually on the radio, on the internet. He does a radio piece for Orit Sheva. So he's really worth hearing. He's got a good sense of humor as well. But he does a lot of work on this, and I've seen his presentation in with a Frum group of kids. I've seen it with a Reform group of kids, and it has the same effect in both situations. It's an unbelievable thing. I don't want to tell you what he does. You know, if you can get to see him, please try and do so. It's really worthwhile. There are a number of people also, various people around the world who are doing this. I don't know what the situation is. So there's always a group called Pe'ilin who come collecting. Very often you might be asked to give money to them, and they fight missionary activity in Israel. And it's all over the place. The tragedy of this was about 10 years ago in London. There was a young boy in Imperial College. And it's a college which is the equivalent of Columbia, I think, in terms of status in England. And my father-in-law, my wife's father, was a professor there at the time. And he told me about this story. This young man was basically there for studying engineering. He'd come from outside London, so he wasn't... he didn't have friends as such. He was very much alone. And these are the people that they focus on, this group. They go for people who are alone. And he was drawn into this group, and they were very friendly, and they came for Friday night. Okay, at the end, they did sing something a bit strange. They did a bit of gospel singing on Friday night. After they did a regular chadodi, they started singing some Jesus songs. It was a bit weird for him, but he didn't pull away. Eventually, he got absolutely involved in the group, and he would go home for the weekend, and on Shabbos, he would go to the synagogue, go to shul, come back to them Saturday night. On Sunday, they would insist that he comes with them to church. And this guy got so confused and so, schizophrenic about it, because he became sick. He became very sick and eventually killed himself. And there was a case of suicide, and it was documented in the London Jewish Chronicle about 1996, about 10 years ago. It's a really frightening scenario, and I imagine it's been repeated in a number of places. These are very, very devious people. I've got a lot of time for Christians in general, I have to say, and I'm going to make this point by way of introduction. If the world, the Christian world, was more Christian, I think the world would be a better place. I really do believe that. There's a lot of morality there. There's a lot of amongst their own sort of people, if they really observe what they were supposed to observe. I just read a phenomenal statistic that the Catholic Church, which is going through, we're going to talk about it, the Catholic Church, which is going through this incredible barrage of court cases, they've settled for over $600 million.
$660 million.
I mean, that's an unbelievable amount of money. And one suspects that that's not the end of it either.
Yes, but they didn't get rid of the priests who were involved.
And they've still got the priests running around, and it's an unbelievable story. Unbelievable. It all came to a head
that's
this week.
Only in LA.
And it's only in LA. So imagine what's going on in Boston and around the world. It's an unbelievable. It really is an unbelievable story. And they've kept everything out of court. They basically want to settle it. They don't want to bring any of their laundry into the public view, the dirty laundry that they have, and we understand. I mean, it's a shanda of the first degree. And again, you know, if the world was a bit more Christian, the Christian world, the statistic in England is very frightening, because it used to be known as a Christian country, Church of England and all that, and I think now the estimate is about 4% of all Church of England members actually go to church once a week. 4% of the members. That's a kind of minimal number. In this country, it's higher. There are a lot of people. I know there's a church near me, which on Sunday is like, it's like Rosh Hashanah. It's amazing. You know, this sort of bursting of the seams, which is a good sign. And again, you know, the point of these presentations is not that we're here to bash the other religion. I don't want to do that. I want to show there's differences between the religions, and that I think is important to understand. But if the other religion, if Christianity, was stronger, and actually sort of, you know, and people, more Christians were Christian in the true sense, I think the world would certainly be a better place. But and the death of Christianity would be a definite tragedy for the world, if it's going to go. And the moment, I don't know, some countries you feel it is, certainly in Europe with the liberalism and everything else that's going on, the general atmosphere is moving away toward, from Christianity, from religious life. Okay, you've still got it happening, and it's happening all over the place, but it's definitely weakening. Alright, so that's just by way of introduction. But what I want to do in these presentations, and today and hopefully tomorrow, is just to show you one thing. When you get that person knocking on your door on a Sunday, saying, you know, I see that you're Jewish, and I've come here to give you some good news. And what's the good news? The good news is that you can still be Jewish and believe in, and they don't use the word Jesus anymore. They use the word Yeshua. They've actually changed the whole style. Because Jesus has got a negative connotation. Okay, certainly in the English-speaking world. Doesn't seem to be in the Spanish-speaking world. Everybody's called Jesus for some reason. But in the English-speaking world, it's really high church, and they've now got called in Yeshua, and Yeshua is gonna you know, help you in your life and everything else, and you know, everything becomes sort of much more anesthetized. And in London, they even set up their stalls, as it were, outside Jewish schools. And they're giving away T-shirts, and they're giving away bumper stickers, and you name it. It's an unbelievable thing. And what I really want people to understand, and that's why, again, I make these presentations, is because when they come to your door, if you want to engage them in conversation, and they say to you, Judaism and Christianity are really one and the same, and we can live together, and we're in harmony with each other, and you can be both at the same time, you really need to know one basic thing, that the whole premise on which they base their argument is wrong. The premise is absolutely wrong. And you can argue with them on a basic logical statement. The logical statement is that if Judaism and Christianity are one and the same, what did you need Christianity in the first place? All right, Judaism would seem to be doing a good job. It was around for a long time. Along came Christianity, and a new religion was created. What do you need it for? Why did you have to create that new religion if you had the old religion still running? Alright, so again, it's kind of, if one is born out of the other, and one is works together with the other, then why need the new one? The old one seemed to be fine, it seemed to be functioning. Okay, and the fact is that the new one went out of its way, and so much of the writing of the early church went out of its way to put down the old religion, and to say there's the old Israel, and the new Israel, and old, and new, and you know, all the terminology that they use. So basically, that's really the question there. And I say this because it becomes a bit shocking. Again, it's sort of small anecdote. This is from England. When I was growing up, there was all these various icons, these people that, you know, sort of either were top of the charts or, you know, the sort of people that you grew up with, the Beatles or whatever. And one of them, which was going back into the 60s, it just shows how shocking this whole thing becomes. There was a young girl, she was 14 at the time, and she sang a song which hit the top of the parade in England. It was really, it was very popular, and they still play it on the radio to this day, it's 40 years later. And her name, nice Jewish name, Helen Shapira, right? It sounds very Jewish, and she really was. She was in school at the time, she was 14 years old in the local public school, and she was known as being a Jewish girl who really did very well. And as soon as she got this hit, she tried another one, didn't succeed, and her mother said, that's it, nice Jewish girl doesn't go into this sort of business, and you get married, and you'll have kids, and you'll be whatever, and she disappeared. And for literally 35 years, you never heard of her. Okay, the record was played again and again, it was always a popular tune, and in terms of the person, completely gone. About 5 or 6 years ago, all of a sudden, there is a revival, and who appears? This girl, this woman now, Helen Shapira. She's in her 40s, late 40s, and all of a sudden she appears, and what is she preaching? She's preaching, unbelievably, the power of Christianity, right? Jews for J. You can be Jewish, I'm Helen Shapira, I'm a nice, proud Jew, and I also, at the same time, believe in Yeshua. And this is what she's coming out with. And it was shocking, it was very frightening. There is a TV show in this country on the New York channels, I think, on a Sunday, where you have these presentations. They're not necessarily famous people who are presenting, but in this case in England, she really was so well known. She was like a household name in London and around, sort of certainly in the south of England. And when she came back and started preaching Christianity, everyone was shocked. And it goes on and on and on. This is something which just won't go away. It doesn't go away, and it's something that we need to be aware of. And again, seeing it on the campuses, the Christians who are working on campus, the mainstream Christian groups, I don't think are very comfortable with this at all. But you've got the fringe groups. There's a group on Columbia where I work called, I think, the Jesus Army or something like that. I don't know what they call themselves. And again, you wonder if this group is really not a cover for all of the sort of evangelical, like this sort of stuff, homing in on students, and you can imagine how many Jewish kids are in Columbia. There are 500 who are actually active in the Hillel. For those 500, there's another 2,000, 3,000 who are just on the campus who have no connection with the Jewish community whatsoever. It's an enormous number of students. And every one of those students is an absolute target, potentially, for these groups. And again, people are trying Chabad, they're trying to do something, working the other direction. There's Eish HaTorah, there are various groups which are trying to do things, but the problem, the numbers are just overwhelming. And you go to LA and the numbers are probably equally as big, and all around the country. And it's really a massive issue. So again, what do we do about this? And I think the first thing that we have to understand is that it's all about awareness. Our children today, our Jewish kids, go to Hebrew school and they get, I wouldn't even use the word pathetic. I would say it's even less than pathetic. The sort of Jewish education which passes for Hebrew education is almost zero. And what we do essentially is that, I don't think we would ever do this in any other language or any other knowledge. We let our children at the age of 13 and girls at the age of 12, we let them loose on the world with a 12-year-old perspective on Judaism, which apparently is meant to get them through the rest of their lives. So, you know, imagine a girl who has a 12-year-old perspective on math or on English, and she's supposed to get through the rest of her life at the basis of a 12-year-old and never ever develops that knowledge. And this is true for the vast majority of Jewish kids. And when they come to college, all of a sudden, everything that they thought they knew about Judaism is being challenged by groups like Jews for J and all the other cults and you name it, what's going on over there. And they have nothing to defend themselves with. We're sending them out into a war, into a battle zone, and they have no defense. They have no knowledge. They really don't know. They don't know the alphabet. The first alphabet about Judaism is unknown to them because they never heard about it because they spent most of their time playing hooky from Hebrew school. And then when the parents were asked at the age of 13, maybe they could stay for a bit longer and do an advanced course, God forbid, my poor kid mustn't get up on a Sunday morning. They need the rest. And that was it. And now we're coming to a point where, you know, these children, unfortunately, when they become students in college, it's unbelievable what's going on. And we can make ourselves, as you say in Yiddish, nish wissendig, you know, we really can just ignore the problem. But it's there. Speak to people working on campuses, and they will tell you all about it. They will tell you, and probably with a tear in their eye as well, what's going on. Again, maybe we can start with a couple of areas of agreement. what I'm basically going to tell you in the next couple of sessions is really the fact that Judaism goes that way and Christianity goes that way. We are 180 degrees apart. If we think that we're actually on a parallel line, it's wrong. There are certain areas of agreement, and this I have to admit, and I think it's well documented, there are three potential areas in which we all agree. We agree about the purpose of man, to do good, right? Asei tov, sum era v'asei tov, is a verse in the Bible, so we can't avoid it. Okay, turn away from evil and do good. Everybody agrees, that's the purpose. Believe in afterlife, and we're going to talk a bit about the different views of Olam Haba, Yenevel. We're going to talk about that in terms of Judaism and Christianity, but the actual belief is common to both religions. And the third belief, which is also interesting, is the idea that God rewards and punishes. Okay, the idea of what is called in Hebrew, Sechar V'Onesh. Okay, if you look at the end of the Siddur of Shacharit, there are the 13 principles of faith of the Rambam. Maimonides wrote this down, and the principle number 11, Ani Ma'amin Be'muna Shleima, I believe, Shabaris Bach Shemo, that God, Go'emel Tov L'Shem Mitzvoso, He gives reward to those who keep the mitzvahs, U'ma'anish Lo Mitzvoso, and the other way around for those who don't. And it's kind of a basic belief in Judaism, right? It's a basic belief in Christianity as well, that there's a reward for doing good, and there is a negative and an opposite for not doing good. And fine, those are areas of agreement. So we can argue maybe that's where we're running on the same direction. But as soon as we start going beneath the surface and looking a bit at Christian doctrine, we begin to realize we have gone off at a complete tangent. Or rather, they've gone off at a complete tangent from where we were standing. And one of the most basic things, and it's so interesting, the whole question of how to achieve the world to come. If we believe in afterlife, we both believe in the concept of getting to the world to come. How do you get there? Or let's make it more basic than that. Who gets there? All right. And there is, again, an anecdote. I don't have the film with me, and it's a great shame. It's on the European system, on a video system, so I need to transfer it, and not easy to do in this country. But I have a film of a program which was put out in London about, again, 11, 12 years ago. The presenter is still doing this stuff, and he's a bit of an atheist. He calls himself an atheist because he always deals with religious issues, but he's tried to stand on the sideline. He doesn't want to commit himself one way or the other. But what he did was, and this is a very interesting story, he made a program, a 30-minute program, and into the studio he brought representatives of every religion based in London at that time. So obviously you had the Church of England, all right, somebody called Bishop Montefiore. I don't want to shock you. Bishop Montefiore is the great-great-grandson of one of the greatest Jews who ever lived. Moses Montefiore's great-great-grandson. And he is a bishop in the Church of England. And he says, I know my history, that I come from a proud Jewish family, but, you know, as time went on, you know, they became very assimilated. And that in itself is a big shock, just to hear him talk about his ancestry. His great-grandfather will be turning over literally in his grave, I suspect. Probably has done already a number of times. But that's the story of Rothschild, and all these well-known English families unfortunately become very assimilated, and another couple of generations they will literally be not even on the fringe of the Jewish community, they were completely out. This is just the way it's gone. So he was representing Church of England. There was a Catholic, I don't remember now the guy's name, there was a Mormon. The Mormons are very interesting. They're baptizing everybody after death. I don't know if you know this. They're taking lists and lists and lists of people and baptizing them. So if you ever want to find out any of the genealogy, you call the Mormons. You actually, I think they even have a webpage based in Salt Lake City. That's the only good thing that comes out of it. What a chutzpah, you know, to say to me after I die that they'll come along and make me you know, baptized, and therefore I can get to heaven. I mean, you know, I don't know who they're trying to kid, but this is the way the Mormons see the world.
Rabbi, I read there were massive protests, and they renounced that prospect.
They renounced it. But at this time, on this TV show, they were still doing it. And they did it proudly, right? This is what they were doing. I'm pleased they renounced it. A good thing came out of it is for genealogists, you have tremendous resources. Because they found out a lot of the, you know, the yichus, if you want to go back. I don't know. I just am very suspicious about all of this stuff. Who else did you have there? You had the best guy was the Southern Baptists. I think they were Southern Baptists or Northern Baptists. I'm not sure what you have
Southern
in England.
Baptist.
Southern Baptists, but you might in England they might be called something. Or Methodists. They call them in England, but it's the same thing. Fire and brimstone. This guy he couldn't speak without giving a drosha for at least 10 minutes of how you're going to, if you don't do this, you don't do that, how are you going to burn here and burn there? He was into fire in a big way. Unbelievable. In terms of the other religions, you had Muslims, okay, which at the time, this is before all the terrorism really became sort of such a front page issue, you had Sikhs in the same, and it was an unbelievable collection. And obviously you had Jews, you had an Orthodox rabbi, a friend of mine was there, and he had a student with him from one of the colleges. And you put this group together, and the basic question was, one of the questions they dealt with is, what is the way, or who gets the chance to come to the world to come? Okay, who's going to be there? So the Christian guys, and not the bishop, but the Methodist, the Baptist guy, right, it's equivalent, he stood up and said, well, it's very simple. He says, either you believe in you-know-who, in JC, or you're never going to get there, period. Right? And that was the whole thing. And he gave a speech for 5 minutes telling everybody that they've got to believe, otherwise they'll never get to the world to come. The Catholic guy was a bit more, he was a bit more careful about what he said. He didn't put it in those terms. The other religions were interesting, not as verbrent, I would say, as that. The Jewish religion came over as being the most amazing. What happened was that the Jews stood up and said that we have a very interesting policy. The policy is that the tradition is there's something called the seven laws of Noah. The seven laws of Noah, when you go back into Genesis after the flood, Noah comes out of the ark and is given seven basic principles of observance, right? Which are known as the seven Noahide laws, the Sheva Mitzvahs, B'nai Noah. And those are laws which apparently we understand if a non-Jew, meaning not necessarily Christian, anyone who keeps those laws will keep them for the sake of keeping the laws of Noah, right? Then he or she is promised a place in the world to come. That, you know, one is even told in terms of the fact that they will get a very honorable place in the world to come. Okay, so you'll have a top table over there, Moshe Rabbeinu on one table with his chevra, his chassidim, and you've got, you know, the what they call the chassidi umas olam. You'll have the righteous non-Jews, and they'll be sitting more or less maybe on the same Mizrach wall, but maybe on different sides, that's all. And this is the kind of image which is presented to you. And it's very, very fascinating. And of all the religions that were able to be, how should we say, a bit more flexible about this, the most flexible was the Jewish religion. There was a congregation, I believe it still exists, in the southern states, I think somewhere in Tennessee or whatever, which became known as a Noahide congregation. Congregation Emmanuel, I think they were called. They consulted an Orthodox Jewish rabbi to find out how to keep these laws, and they decided to base their whole religious perspective on these laws. They didn't want to become Jewish. And this is, by the way, the reason why we don't encourage conversion. It's very simple. As a convert, as a non-Jew, you've got seven laws to keep. All right? Easy. Most of you do anyway. You've got to, you don't kill anybody. Hopefully most people don't. You don't murder. You don't steal. You blaspheme. You're not supposed to take the name of God in vain or to be blasphemous or whatever. You're not supposed to commit adultery. Alright, it's a challenge maybe nowadays, but hopefully most people manage to avoid that. Don't eat a limb from a living animal. In other words, be kind to animals. Okay, that's a very sort of popular thing to be. And establish courts of law. So have a court of law, which again, you know, we live in a society where the rule of law is very, very strong. So most people, if they kept these laws and understood and kept them the way they're supposed to be kept, it's much easier to get to the world to come, if that's what you're worried about, than becoming Jewish. All of a sudden you've got 613 commandments, and you've got all these issues about, you know, sort of different laws and different nuances and rabbinic law and all the rest of it, and it's not really doing anybody any favors by converting to Judaism. The way you look at it.
We put them off.
We didn't at one time, before Christianity, we were very evangelical, it's interesting. Because the Talmud that we're going to read on Tisha B'Av, that famous story, talks about the Emperor Nero. Yeah. And the Emperor Nero converted to become Jewish. All right, according to Jewish tradition, that's why the Romans said he went mad. All right, they made up this whole story that he was fiddling and Rome was burning. What he actually was doing was becoming Jewish, because he saw that the God of Israel was going to bring terrible retribution against the Roman Caesar, was going to destroy Jerusalem. He didn't want to have anything to do with it. So he ran off and apparently went to Israel, became converted, and his great whatever grandson was Rabbi Meir, the very famous rabbi of the Talmud. So, you know, there was evangelical acts going on in Roman Jewish community. It was very, very popular to become Jewish. until Christianity came along around the first century of the Common Era, and, you know, what happens then is that the Jews sort of close ranks. And then, of course, the Talmudic tradition grows up where it's much more restricted. We put people off. We tell them not to join and not to do this, and do you know what's going to happen? And, you know, the Beth Din really gives them a very hard time. Again, what we see very simply is that if you are believing, certainly in terms of the Jewish approach, you don't have to believe in anybody, essentially, to get to the world to come. For the Christians, it's absolutely fundamental Christian doctrine. If you don't believe in the Savior of Christianity, you're not going to get there. Period. Whether you scream about it, whether you do fire and brimstone speeches, or whether you just have it as part of your Christian doctrine, as exists in the Catholic Church, but it's certainly part of the doctrine, the reality is that whichever way you look at it, we have a very different approach to entrance into the world to come. It just doesn't work. We are clearly like at 180 degrees from the Christian Church, and there's no discussion about that. All right? There's not even a remote possibility of bringing those two ideas together. So, again, difference number one. And what we'll see here, we've got really massive, major, massive differences, which we're going to highlight to the point where you're going to say to me that nobody in their right mind can say that these two religions are parallel. They're really not parallel. One more we're going to talk about today, and then the others we'll talk about tomorrow. And again, I preface this with an anecdote, because there is a very wonderful gentleman going around the world who you may have come across. And he is now, if he appears in your shul on the Shabbat, he will be wearing a tall fur hat and a black coat. And he comes over as being, it looks like what they call a Gera Chassid. Gera Chassid are the guys with the black socks, as opposed to the other Chassidim with the white socks. And that's the difference, the Satmas with the white socks. He's Gera. Now, what's the story? This guy's name is Asher Wade. He was known as the Reverend Wade at one time. Reverend, not in the Jewish sense, Reverend in the Methodist or in the German church. The story goes with this guy, and he tells you this story quite openly. He's standing there, you look at this guy, and you don't believe what you're hearing. He was a priest, a minister in the church in Germany. And he went to Germany specifically for various technical reasons, and many people have heard his speech. And what happened was that he started researching Holocaust, and he started reading about the history of the Jewish people, and he became very interested. And at the same time, he started having a religious crisis. What was the religious crisis? He's a priest, right? So his crisis was the following, that when it came to Sunday morning, his day starts off incredibly busy. He's got Mass, and he's got the Sunday school, and he's got who knows what's going on, and the socials, and Sunday dinner, and you know, you name the whole thing. And the whole day of Sunday, he's running like a headless chicken all over the place. And it came to Monday morning, nothing happened. Came to Tuesday morning again, the whole day, empty. All right, went to visit people in hospital, maybe had a few things to do, but very quiet. And all the way through, till he gets the next Sunday, and then all of a sudden he's like a headless chicken all over again. And he was very disturbed by this. He said, this is a religion which gives me a tremendous amount to do one day of the week, and the rest of the week, you know, I can literally live in blissful ignorance and nothing happens. And he talks about it, and he researched Judaism. I don't know whether he spoke to someone, I'm not sure whether he made contact in Germany or whether he made contact elsewhere, but he did make inquiries about this, and eventually he found that in Jewish life, he was very impressed particularly by the concept that Judaism literally legislates how you get out of bed in the morning, all right? You know, how you do up your shoes, how you get dressed. I mean, everything is mentioned in halakha, pardon the expression, even how you go to the bathroom. It's all there. It's unbelievable. And Judaism doesn't shy away from these things. It's human life. It's an explanation of how to behave. Obviously, there are the festivals and the you know, throughout the year, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, etc., etc. But the fact is that he felt that the religion had a structure, and he was looking for structured religious life. So the shocking thing, and how his family dealt with this, I just do not know. I don't remember even asking the question, but certainly his community must have been amazing. One day he stands up and says, I'm going to leave because I've decided that Judaism is the religion and I'm becoming Jewish. And you see him now, and he's become Hasidic, and he lives in Jerusalem, and he gives a lot of talks around Yerushalayim to, if any of your grandchildren, for instance, have been through the seminary programs in Israel, he talks to a lot of the seminaries. I know he gives these talks. And occasionally he comes to America. He was in my shul twice in the last few years. And he usually comes on behalf of Baruch Sameach, one of these organizations. Now, one of the things that, as I said, which he really picks on is the fact that when it comes to the difference between Judaism and Christianity, and he stresses this very strongly, he says, Christianity, you can be the greatest philosopher in the world, right? You sit and philosophize, you theologize, right? You're a theological person, meaning that if you really take Christianity seriously, there's a lot of reading to do. I even saw a book over here on one of the bookshelves here, History of the Church. Very fascinating. You want to read that sort of book. And there's tons of things to read, tons of things to think about. But in terms of doing, there's almost nothing, right? Love your neighbor. Now, that's about it. Okay, I mean, I don't know, whatever. Maybe Christians have certain sort of what you would call mitzvot, but it's not called that. There's no concept. Just be a good person in a very generic and very, very sort of almost airy-fairy sort of way. And Judaism, of course, is not really about philosophizing. It's there, of course. Maimonides was one of the greatest Jews ever lived, was one of the greatest philosophers who ever lived. But the reality is the focus about doing, right? Nasa v'nishma, when we started off the religion, we said we'll do, and then nishma, we'll learn about it, we'll find out later on. We'll philosophize about it, you know, in due course. But the main thing is doing. Okay, how do I get up? How do I do this? How do I put on tefillin? How do I daven? How do I do this? How do I light the Shabbos candles? How do I make kosher? Everything is about doing. It's about from morning to night, from 1 week to the next, 1 year to the next. It's a religion of action. It's not a religion necessarily of philosophy. It's part of the religion, but it's not the focus. It's not being Jewish. It's not to be a philosopher. Being Jewish is about doing. It's about what do you teach a kid from the age of three? Don't sit down and have a philosophical sort of conversation with a three-year-old. You teach them how to daven, how to alphabet, how to say the words and whatever it is. And it's fascinating. If you think about Abraham, when he's meeting the angels, right? That famous story. What's going on over there? Right? Does he sit down? He knows that these are angels from God. So what would you think? If he was a good Christian, what would he have sat down and would have had a conversation with them? What's going on in heaven, and what is the philosophical approach to this? What does Abraham do for them? He makes food. He makes his food. He makes kiddush. All right, you know, he's got a food supply, whatever, and he cooks up a meal, because that's what you do. You don't sit and philosophize. You sit and feed people. Okay, you'll actually sit there and give them something to eat. You may have had the conversation afterwards, and that we're not told about necessarily. Certainly not in the Pesukim, but whatever it is. But the basic thing is about doing. It's not necessarily about philosophizing, but it's about doing. And there is a remarkable statement taken in the Talmud Yerushalmi, where God, as it were, is put into a conversation, where God says something really remarkable. And the words that he's used, this is the quote from the Talmud, She'ilu oti azvu v'torati shamara. God is saying, I don't care, even if they don't believe in me, even if they forsake me, all right, but v'torati shamara, as long as they keep the Torah, as long as they keep doing. Famous story, the story in Auschwitz, and whether this really happened, I don't know. But there were three rabbis who decided, after all the terrible things that were happening around them, that they had to put God on trial. They made a Beis Din, three rabbis, like they do a Beis Din, and they put God on trial. And the trial lasted for 3 days. And they were arguing, is God guilty, is God innocent, what's going on around us? And at the end they said, Rabosa, we've got to make a decision. And the decision was made, the Beis Din decided God was guilty. And that was their decision. Then one of the guys looked out of the window, he saw the sun was going down. So he said, Rabosa, we've got a dumb minta. Alright, and they turned around, they stopped the court case, and they dumb minta. Now, it's got a bit of pathos. It's a story, but it's a powerful story. Now, on the one hand, you know, the Jews can say, God is guilty. What happens next? You daven mincha. All right? Because you're always doing something. Even if you've got doubts, even if you've got questions, and that circumstance, what questions they must have had. But at the same time, that's what you do. Because Judaism is really the doing. It's not about the philosopher. It is eventually going to be about the philosophizing as well, but that's not the focus. The focus is the doing. Focus is how do you conduct yourself as a Jew from day to day, literally from almost, you can say, from minute to minute. And that is the very big difference. For Christianity, it's all about the whole question of beliefs. When it comes to Judaism, it's about action. Okay, and it doesn't mean belief is not important, but it's secondary. Certainly action is what it's about. Secondary comes belief, whereas in Christianity, the original Christianity basically ditched all the actions, and it became essentially all about beliefs. Okay, and you read the early history of the church, and you'll see the particularly what is known as Pauline Christianity. Paul, the very famous disciple of Jesus, afterwards basically formulated the religion. Jesus was a nice Jewish boy. We're told he kept kosher, he kept Shabbos to whatever extent, he kept Hanukkah, right? His people, the Judeo-Christians, were people we would recognize today, probably more to the Reform side of Judaism, but they kept a lot of Jewish tradition. Along came Paul later on and decided how we're going to sell this to the public. Paul would have been a very, very good salesman, you know, somebody even more than that in advertising, and Madison Avenue would have a great job, because he managed to sell Christianity to the whole world. Because there was nothing to do. It was all a question of belief. Take hold of the cross and away you go. You're a believer. And that is so fundamentally different from Judaism. Judaism, we're off in the world of action. Christianity is off in the world of belief. Alright? And again, no, that is such a different approach. It really is totally, totally opposite. So what have we seen today? I'm going to sort of bring it to a conclusion. Maybe there are questions. That in two areas so far, we see that we're really very, very different. Getting to the world to come, you know, we've got an open policy as far as we're concerned. Yeah, everyone can join the fun if they want to. Whereas in Christian terms, if you don't believe, you're not saved, as it were, to use the language of Christianity, you're out of it. You're not going to get there. And the second thing, which is the focus in the religion itself, is it about doing or is it about believing? And clearly, Judaism and Christianity have two different focuses, totally different. And as we go on, you'll see tomorrow we'll talk a bit about the issues of the what I call the mathematics of Christianity, which is a very serious question. We once had a Christian priest at our Seder, somebody that I was working with in London. He was a wonderful man, still is, wonderful guy. And all the questions that we're going to raise tomorrow, I raised with him at the Seder. After about sort of 2 or 3 hours of this, the poor guy looked a bit battered. He looked a bit worse for wear. And I said, I did invite you to have to get roasted like this. You know, I said the whole idea was that I just want to understand. I really want to understand what you believe. And you know, sort of questions like the whole question of original sin as opposed to free will. You know, we're going to talk about a bit about that tomorrow. Any comments? Any questions from the audience? Just 1 second. Yeah. Yeah.
Talk about all this. Comparison. Well, we went through all those thousands of years. Now that the Western generations in America, the newborn Christians, the right.
Yeah.
They support Israel.
Yeah, excellent question. Excellent. Excellent.
Would you repeat what you said?
I'll repeat what he said in a second. The question of the newborn. I want. I just take the point, and because we're short on time, I just.
Yeah. You should bring this out, how this can happen.
Yeah, it's very strange. There is a whole group of Christians who seem to be very supportive of Israel. How do we come to terms with that? And they're pouring billions of dollars. There is an Aliyah organization called Nefesh B'Nefesh, which started the seed money for that organization started with money from Christian groups, particularly from the southern part of the States, the Bible Belt, as it is called.
They keep quiet
on a lot of things, right? I'm not in any way here to defend the Israeli government on certain things. How do we understand it? I honestly believe, I mean, what has happened with Nefesh B'Nefesh, by the way, and this I spoke to the guy who organizes it, his parents now live in my shul, they live in my neighborhood, so he comes every so often to America, and that has changed. That money is now no longer received from the Christian groups for the, no more. And the reason why they started it like that is because it had to get going. And that was the offer that was made. The Christian groups, this Christian group is very positive towards Israel, but their agenda is, again, a Christian agenda. What they basically want to see is the Messiah come back. And the only way that they believe is going to happen is if every Jew lives in Israel. All right, it's a different slant. It used to be that everyone had to embrace Christianity for Jesus to come back. That's why they were evangelical. They were converting everybody. Now they say a different thing. And I don't know why they're different on this particular point. I don't know. But just 1 second. And the whole point, therefore, is that they became very pro-Israel, not necessarily because of the love of Jews, but for wanting to bring the end of days. All right? Now, has that benefited the Jewish people? In the short term, the answer is probably yes. But I'm very wary, again, that once they get a foothold in Israel, which they obviously have, where does it go from here? come back in 20 years' time, are they still nice and friendly, or are they saying, well, you know, we're now in Israel, maybe we can indulge in a bit more of the, how should we say, the more evangelical activity, which they've obviously been indulging in the past. So, as I said, I'm very skeptical about this. Yeah, just one point, and then we'll take one more question.
Yes, in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
The sesame.
Yeah.
They support the Muslim.
Not
they,
true.
Yes, they
no.
Are
you're talking about a very small group amongst them who went. Yeah. They went to that conference, and it was a very small group of very, very sick individuals. That's all I can say.
Can they afford to bring up to the world that kind of a, just the eye seen for a Jew, a religious Jew,
standard. Yeah, there, it's got nothing to do with this shir, but it's got everything to do, unfortunately, with the fact that this is a group of very, very disturbed people. I know one from London who was literally should have been committed. I mean, I'm sorry to say, and the tragedy was that as a movement, it had a validity once upon a time. Even if I didn't agree with it, their point of view was, as long as it kept within the Jewish framework, right? Meaning that if they disagreed with the state of Israel, okay, they had a reason to disagree, whether you like what they said or not. But now that they've taken it out of that framework and they've gone over to the Palestinian side, and they now show themselves with the Iranians and everybody else, then they've lost it completely. And they really, if today a cherem could be made, then these guys are the focus, certainly as far as I'm concerned, of what we would call cherem, excommunication. They should be excommunicated from the community. Without a doubt, but just... Sorry? It's being spoken, it has been spoken about. If we give them more publicity than they deserve, then of course that's a problem. So really, one of the best ways to deal with it is just to ignore it. But I know it doesn't go away because they're very prominent. The way they look very Jewish, so you think this is representing Orthodox Jews, and it really isn't. It's representing a bunch of crazies, but that's a different problem.
Yeah.
And it's it's very difficult. Your point is taken. Just a second. Yeah, it's a problem.
I just wanted to mention two things. One, I had an experience just about a week ago, an actual wave experience.
Oh, yeah.
I dove in a yeshiva.
Yeah.
And everybody, black hat and you know, short coat. And I see him walking out, and I see this tall young man walking out with a talis over me, up an Arab with a talis over me. That's how when you're wearing a shleimel.
Yeah.
I mentioned to my son, who was in the kollel there, he says, a year ago, that fellow was walking around without a hat, without even a kippah.
Yeah.
Now he's wearing a shtreimel, you know, a bekesh, and a gartel. So the transformation, you know, from one thing to the other.
I'm worried about quick transformations, I have to tell you, but that's the way it goes.
The other thing was, when I was a graduate student, I worked in a lab. There was another fellow there, his name was Morton Rothbard.
Yeah.
Nice Jewish name, and I thought he was a Jewish guy. I know he probably wasn't from, because he didn't have a yeshiva background like most people. And he's on the phone calling his wife, and I all of a sudden I hear him say, so what time are we going to church on Sunday?
Yeah.
Bethlehem is good.
Yeah.
So I begin to talk to him. He says, well, I married this shiksa, and I follow her tradition. So about a year or two later, when I finished, I met him. I said, no, what's with you? He said, oh, I gave that up already. Got divorced, and I just married, I went to the church only to please her.
Yeah.
This was just a passing phase.
Right.
So at that time, years ago, you know, this was, you know, the sort of in thing to do. It wasn't, you know, out of
just
conviction.
Just join
the church because your wife was there and made her happy.
Yeah.
But nowadays, it's much more subtle.
It is more subtle. And what worries me with Jews today is that they're not now really just concentrating on the fringes, but they're going for been to the student body, who are very intelligent kids, right?
Yeah.
They know nothing. They are so ignorant of Judaism, it's frightening, but they are very, very intelligent kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are the ones who are
the...
And they haven't got and we, as educators, you know, I feel so strongly about this. My son is involved with NCSY, and they're doing programs now in public schools to educate Jewish kids that when they go to college, they'll have some ammunition to fight back. Because they've got nothing to say when they throw the Bible at them and they quote Isaiah and they quote, you know, all the various things that they quoted them to say, proving that Jesus is it.
Right.
Then they have not. The Jewish kids know nothing. To them, it's so authentic and so real that they just get sucked in by it.
One is a
very frightening.
Tomorrow?
Sorry?
What time is your lecture?
Mitzvah Hashem tomorrow, same time, same place. Okay. And maybe down at the pavilion. If it's really nice weather, much nicer to sit outside than it is to sit inside. Everybody agrees about that. It really is, I can just tell you. But we'll see how the weather is. So please check.
I mean outside record?
Outside, no, the pavilion, down in the pavilion. The bottom. Okay. There. So Mitzvah Hashem will be there tomorrow. Okay, thank you everybody. Appreciate it. Thank you. We're done, yeah, because I think there's maybe something else coming in. Mitzvah Hashem to be continued. Thank you.